over the noises in the house. Revolution is for the young, she considered, before remembering the tragic fates of Macaretta and Aiden. No, that's not true. The young are too foolish. Although the youthful benefited from drive, ambition, and an unwavering faith in their ideals, having those tools wasn't enough. Experience was an essential missing ingredient. The young hadn't seen enough to understand how the world worked. They took everything at face value, because that was the entirety of their reality, and that limitation locked the door to alternative possibilities. To those who had glimpsed just a fraction of the landscape, assumptions were rampant and dangerous. Only by riding the slow river of time could a person distinguish the what is from the what was, and determine the likelihood of what could be. That comparison granted wisdom and understanding. Some things were eternal, others could be temporarily altered, but a few things, a very few, could be changed such that the world shifted forever. Sacrifices made for the unchangeable, or even the short term, were foolish. But like those who are colorblind and faced with a red, green, and yellow door, the young couldn't tell the difference. So it's up to me, Imali sighed. From the other side of the wall, the banging started again. Muffled shouts were followed by laughter coming from the bedroom. When Suri had first arrived, Imali had been concerned that the Mystic and Macaretta would clash, and such a conflict would drive Macaretta into a deeper depression. If that had happened, it could have made both of the artists useless to the curator. To her surprise and good fortune, bonds of friendship had risen from their recent tragic pasts. Imali's second concern was Suri's presence attracting attention from the neighbors. Adding such a high-profile individual to her home was bound to draw interest. Imali had nightmares of Frey from the outer villages knocking on her door and asking to see Suri. As it turned out, that didn't happen. No one wanted anything to do with the rune, and everyone avoided Estranodon now that the Fane was making dragons. Even those already in the city sequestered themselves in their homes, fearing a knock on their door. Vidar had made the first dragon, and had done so not far from Avampatha. Imali often wondered what that trip had been like. Had he talked to his sister, explained that he didn't have a choice, or had he spent the time weeping and begging for forgiveness? Suri had explained to Imali what was necessary to play the deep chords, which explained why the runes only had a single dragon. Lothian would want more. Imali knew that. Everyone did. And that's why the residents of Estranodon stayed in their homes, hiding behind doors and hoping the knock wouldn't come. The only two people who didn't worry about being sacrificed were the young women roughhousing in the next room. For all Imali's fear that Suri and Macaretta would coexist as well as fire and water, it turned out the two were remedies for each other. Their unlikely friendship had done wonders for Macaretta's depression, and hopefully dulled the sharp edge of mistrust Gerard had fostered in Suri by his early mistreatment of her. Thump! The portrait of Glendora Fane that hung on the wall rattled and tilted askew.
Stop it! Imali erupted. Whatever it is you two are doing, stop!
The curator collapsed into a sunlit chair in the little nook that looked out on her vegetable garden, now lost in snow. Did you call us? Macaretta came around the partition, wearing her filthy smock and a guilty expression. Suri lagged behind. She wore Imali's best assica, which was now tailored to fit.
Must you tear my house apart?
Imali got up and straightened the picture.
We were just... I don't care what you were doing. I can't take much more.
What's wrong? Macaretta took a tentative step. and Amali noticed the girl had a hammer in her hand.
What in the name of Feral are they doing?
Nothing, Amali lied, this time out of convenience rather than anything else. She didn't want to explain how she felt like a grape being pressed into wine. The members of the Aquila were losing their resolve, and Vasek seemed to be wavering as well. He was a fragile piece of expensive crystal she'd left at the edge of a table, and the wind was rising. On top of everything else, innocent people were dying, or would be soon. So much had been laid on her shoulders. The legacy of her ancestors, the outcome of the war, and the future of the Frey people. She held the lever, and the burden of pulling it. And each night, she came home to the antics of Suri and Makareta. Imali sighed.
But it is time to go over a few things, so please sit down, both of you.
The two pulled over chairs, moving them to the shadows to avoid the blinding sun that pierced the windows. Realizing the drapes were open, Imali closed them before returning to her chair.
It'd be cosmic justice if someone spotted Makareta and reported me. Especially now that this is almost over.
Buy a few things.
Do you mean...
Makareta began, her voice dropping in volume and rising in seriousness. Imali nodded as she took her seat once more, then focused on Suri, who, despite Imali's efforts to keep an open mind, appeared ridiculous when dressed in an assegai. Even with the alterations, it was both too big and the wrong style. This was the dress Imali usually reserved for formal settings, and to see a rune wrapped in it was to witness the clashing of extremes. In many ways, this collision was appropriate, as Suri was a monument to contradictions.
I don't know if you've heard, Imali began, but a dragon has been successfully created.
Where? Suri asked, her grim tone making Makareta's sound casual.
Avampatha.
Imali tensed. This was the first of three dangerous hurdles she would have to clear, and none of them would be easy.
I told you I wouldn't allow my people to be hurt.
Suri's words were delivered as a threat. Imali wasn't surprised. She'd expected it. But there was a difference between suspecting a pet bear could turn on you and actually hearing it growl. Imali had already learned that Suri wasn't a subtle person, so the curator knew the tone wasn't being used to intimidate. Imali faced the point of a sharpened spear as she spoke her next words carefully.
I have not forgotten our agreement, and please note that I could have kept this information from you, but didn't. That event has accelerated our need to act quickly. Tomorrow night, I'll hold an official meeting of the Aquila, where we will pass a resolution to remove Lothian from the throne. The following day, we will kill him, fulfilling my part of our bargain.
Imali waited and watched Suri, who knitted her tattooed brows in thought. As much as Imali wanted to get through this quickly, she understood the value of patience. She couldn't rush. Accidents happened when people pushed ahead too fast.
Has there been an attack on my people? The mystic asked. As far as I understand the situation, the dragon cleared the river camp and drove off the soldiers stationed there. This first beast's purpose is for defense. More will be made for attacking, which is why, in order to stay true to our agreement, I have moved up my schedule. Is that satisfactory? Or will you kill me now?
Makareta's eyes widened, and she straightened up, turning to get a better view of Suri, and looking at the mystic like she had just morphed into something else.
What kind of deal did you two have?
Neither answered as Suri stared at Imali. From the cold glare, the curator wondered if she had overplayed her hand, misjudged the girl.
You're not telling the whole truth, Sori said.
Imali swallowed, holding still, fearful of betraying anything.
She's using magic, but she can't read minds. No Miraleith can.
Silence had never been so deafening as when those three sat facing one another. To the ignorant observer, they were three females chatting in a kitchen when a disagreement arose. For Imali, the world and everyone in it swung on what would happen next. She forced herself to take even breaths, as she wondered if Macaretta would defend her if Sori decided to melt off the curator's skin.
You're lying to me, Sori said. But...
With the thought of her skin hissing and crackling as it dripped down her body, Imali was never so happy to hear the word but in her life.
Yes, but that doesn't matter.
Arion's path goes through you.
It has to. I'm sure of it.
So you let me live?
Sori nodded.
Well, that's good to hear, Macaretta said with exaggerated nonchalance.
What just happened?
Fortunately, nothing.
Imali took a deep breath as she prepared for the next hurdle.
Might as well get all of them over with at once.
Addressing the young Miraleith, she said,
But that doesn't mean we're done.
Now it's your turn.
Mine?
Macaretta asked. She looked at Sori and then back at Imali, as if they were co-conspirators in some fiendish plot.
I have a favor to ask. A rather terrible one.
Once more, Macaretta straightened in her chair, bracing for bad news. After that last bout, the Miraleith appeared unquestionably frightened.
The Fane is protected by two bodyguards, Sine and Sile. I suspect Sile will be of little consequence, but Sine is a Miraleith, and she has a reputation for being incredibly fast. In order to kill the Fane, Sine must be eliminated first.
You want me to kill her?
Macaretta asked. Imali fixed her jaw and returned a grave nod.
Is that all? That's the terrible thing?
Yes,
Imali replied.
I'm asking you to murder her.
Macaretta smiled, then began to chuckle.
Not a problem.
Imali found her cavalier response unexpected and a bit disturbing.
Are you certain?
She killed Aiden, Macaretta said. I'd be more than happy to eliminate her.
One more death won't make a difference.
Well then, good.
Imali paused and smoothed the wrinkles on the lap of her assegai, where she had unconsciously been squeezing a fistful of material.
Time for the last hurdle.
All of this will happen very quickly. Everyone needs to know what to expect. So let's go over this, shall we?
Sori and Macaretta glanced at each other, both shrugged. Childish gestures for those who would soon hold the fate of tens of thousands in their hands. For this next part, Imali stood up. She wasn't prone to pacing back and forth, but she found walking to be calming. The room was small, so she was forced to orbit the little nook's wooden table. Legend held that it was the one her great-grandfather, Aeon, had crafted for Glyndora, and it had been the reason her great-grandmother had fallen in love with him. Why something as mundane as a table had formed the foundation of their love was a mystery to Imali, and everyone else. It didn't matter. Some things just were.
At my urging, Imali started, the Fane will give a state-of-the-war address in the Arenthian the day after tomorrow. When he does, I want both of you there.
Sori won't be allowed inside, so she will need to wait on the steps.
Why should I be there at all?
The mystic asked.
Absolutely no reason. If everything goes as planned, and let's hope that will be the case. My greatest wish is that you spend an hour being bored while watching the proceedings through the archway.
But should things not follow my plan, you're my insurance, and I expect you to step in and protect me, the members of the Aquila, and the peace we intend to offer your people. Is that too much to ask? I'll be there,
Sori said. But it did not escape Amali's notice that she hadn't answered the question.
And what about me? Exactly how and when should I act? Macaretta asked. You will come to the Orenthian the same way you visited Vasek, with your hood raised and using that blocking shield that hides your Miralith powers. Since it's winter, no one will find it odd that your hood is up. Inside, people will be standing around, talking in small groups. I'll be in the center. Find me. Volhorek and I will position you behind the dais. There are two massive, staggered sets of pillars there, 8 or 9 feet in diameter, at least. That'll be more than enough to disappear behind. Everyone in attendance has been hand-picked and briefed, so no one will take notice. I'm only concerned about someone unexpected wandering in, and, of course, Sile and Sine. So keep yourself out of sight. When the Fane sits down, Sine will position herself on Lothian's right, and Sile will be on his left. Won't they search the Orenthian before the Fane enters?
They never do.
Why not?
Why would they?
Macaretta glanced at Sori, who gave no indication of caring one way or the other. Oh, I don't know. Maybe to make sure no one is lying in wait to kill the guy they're protecting, perhaps? We did try to assassinate him once before, after all.
No,
not we, Imali said. That was you and your friends. But that was years ago, and we both know what happened to those who participated in the Grey Cloak Rebellion. Lothian feels quite safe these days. He sees himself as our beloved god leader who is shielded by the fact that Frey don't kill Frey. He only fears the runes, and they are across the river, much too far away to be of any concern. I'm not across the river, Sori pointed out. True, Imali nodded. But he still believes you are inhibited by the Orinfor collar. Any threat from you would be physical, and Sine and Sile would be more than enough to stop you before you got too close. The only true threat would be a Miralith, and as far as Lothian knows, all of them are several days away, except for his bodyguard, himself, and his son. Vasek knows I'm still alive. What if he or someone from the Aquila has had a change of heart and warned Lothian? Macaretta asked. Then I suspect where you stand won't make the slightest bit of difference. Besides, if that were so, we would have been arrested. Are you still concerned, or can we move on? Imali waited, but Macaretta remained silent. Now then, as the Fane delivers his speech, you will kill Sine. Yours will be the action that triggers all else, so time it for a minute or so into his address. Afterward, it would be in your best interest to eliminate Sile, as he will likely be coming for you. Shouldn't I kill Lothian first? No. You're only there for Sine and Sile. Then who will? And how? Macaretta asked. Imali stopped walking. We're hoping to convince Mwandulay. At the mention of the name, both women reacted. Sori's brows rose, and Macaretta began shaking her head as she leaned forward in the wooden chair. No. No. Mwandulay can't kill his father. If he does, he'll lose his soul. He won't. Imali, we've talked about this. I can't allow it. I won't let him... Imali held up her hands. He won't lose his soul. Not for this. I have it on the highest authority. What are you talking about? Volhorek, Ferrol's high priest, has pointed out that Lothian has shattered his covenant with Ferrol. When he murdered Amadea, an innocent, he forever revoked his standing as a Frey who is protected by Ferrol's law. This one act, just like yours, has ejected him from our society.
so he can be killed without any repercussions whatsoever.
Are you certain?
Volhoric has assured me of this, and he will testify as such before the Aquila, when we reveal our intentions and ask Mwandalay to save us. But,
Macareta hesitated,
having him kill his own father, that's a lot to ask.
It is, but we have no choice.
Mwandalay knows better than anyone about the perils of having Lothian's rule continue.
He'll do what's needed.
But what if you're wrong about his soul being safe? Macareta said. Mine is already gone, so I should be the one.
You can't kill Syne and Lothian and Sile, not without taking down the whole Arinthian and everyone else with it, can you?
Afraid that our own lack of understanding about the art might grant Macareta a means to dispute the statement, Emali quickly added,
even if you could, it's too risky. Syne is formidable, and this is too important for half measures. We'll need two artists.
Then why don't you have Suri do it?
Macareta said. Emali was genuinely shocked at the suggestion.
You might not have noticed, Mac, but Suri is a rune, a race we are presently at war with.
What do you think will be the reaction when the people discover the Aquila invited our enemy to kill our leader?
Mwandalay has the best chance of success. Syne, Sile, and you will be behind Lothian, and the Fane will have to turn to see what is happening.
This will provide Mwandalay, who will be seated with the other Aquila members in the gallery in front of Lothian, with the perfect opportunity to attack without his father having any chance to defend himself. Moreover, Lothian wouldn't expect his son to be an assassin. It must be him.
Macareta considered this. She didn't look like she agreed, but the fight was draining from her.
And then he will be Fane, correct?
Yes, Mac, Emali said.
With Syne dead and Fidar on the frontier, I can't imagine anyone else, any non-Miralith, would take the risk to challenge him. Even you can't do it. The horn won't sound for you because you're no longer a Frey. Besides, after the Fane is dead, I'll be presenting the horn to Suri.
Why?
Macareta asked, glancing between them.
For two reasons. One, it was part of the deal I made with Suri, an even trade. She gave Lothian the ability to create dragons, which threatened her people, and I promised her the horn to restrain ours. We both have the means to rule over each other, but this whole affair has been a gamble that we both are sincere about seeking peace. Giving her the horn will provide the appropriate leverage to ensure Mwandalay negotiates peace with the runes.
How does her having the horn do that?
Normally, the Aquila holds it. When a Fane dies, his eldest child is instantly recognized as a candidate for the throne. By virtue of keeping the horn, the Aquila decides who can blow it, and who can challenge the heir to be Fane. But that isn't actually a requirement. We could refuse to let anyone use it, and the child will become Fane.
Sort of.
What do you mean, sort of?
Emali took a big breath and blew it out so her cheek quivered.
What I wouldn't do for a chalkboard right now.
The Horn of Glyndora wasn't a simple artifact. Its rules were detailed, arcane, complex, and often confusing to outsiders, meaning those who were not the curator or conservator of the horn. Explanations were never easy, but in this case, providing one would be necessary.
If the horn isn't blown, no challenge has been declared, and there is no time limit to make one. So, while Mwandalay will have the powers of Fane, any Frey can still blow the horn at any time to challenge him, which means if Mwandalay doesn't work toward peace, then Suri can seek a challenger of her choosing. Then Mwandalay would need to fight her choice or concede his position. Of course, Suri won't need to do that because Fane Mwandalay's first act will be to declare peace between the Frey and the runes,
Or at least, that will be my counsel. And Wanderlei has grown to trust my opinion over the years. Margareta asked, so there's normally a time limit?
Yes. For instance, when a thane dies and he has no heir,
in that case, there would generally be two challengers.
The first person to blow it starts a cycle that ends after the passing of a full day and night. If no one else blows the horn during that time, the first person becomes thane.
So, if the horn is used to challenge for the throne, why wouldn't an heir just blow it himself? Wouldn't that prevent him from being challenged?
Emali shook her head.
No, it wouldn't work.
The horn already accepts the heir as a blood candidate for the throne, and it only sounds to announce a challenger. When it does, an announcement to all Frey is issued, and the day-night cycle starts. This gives potential candidates time to put their names forth and for the Aquila to choose the best candidate.
The rune girl sat with arms folded across her chest in an obstinate manner.
I didn't know Mwandalay would be the new Fane. He killed Arion.
Sorry, do you want revenge or peace?
Take your pick.
You can't have both.
Imali waited. When neither had anything more to say, she nodded decisively.
Good. Now we all know where things stand, and may Feral help us.
Mac, at the Aquila meeting, we'll need your help convincing Wanderlei he has to be the one to kill his father. I think once we give him assurances that he'll be in no danger of losing his soul, that he'll go along. But you should also stay with him afterward and gauge his resolve. If you think there's a chance he won't go through with it, you'll need to let me know right away. Can you manage that?
Margareta grinned, and Amali felt a stab of pain. Margareta was the obvious choice to help persuade the prince. She'd already seduced him once, so she could do it again.
By all accounts, the girl seemed to genuinely like Mwandalay and had always wanted the prince to be fane. She might even be in love with him.
It was possible she expected Mwandalay to forgive her crimes, accept her back into Frey society, and marry her. Then the two would live thousands of years together. Such were the dreams of youth. That bliss could be achieved so easily and sustained indefinitely.
It weighed on Imali's conscience that she didn't set Margareta straight about the realities of life.
Guilt. That's what's making me feel so terrible.
Imali had always wondered if she had missed something by not having a child, a daughter, someone who could bang on the wall of her bedroom when she was trying to think. Now she had two. And instead of bestowing her love, she was using them. Every day together made matters worse.
I like them too much. This betrayal is going to kill me. They are not my daughters,
Imali reminded herself. Even if they were, she would still have to go through with it. The stakes were higher than any single life, or two, or three. Imali wondered where the pros and cons finally evened out. At what point did the deaths and betrayals become too great?
They aren't my daughters.
Imali let the thought repeat in her head as it fought to be heard over the cries of her own heart.
Chapter 6. The Cave. Hope is a fragile thing. Despair. A Hammer. The Book of Brynn.
Brynn couldn't understand what had happened to them, and why her drop had been so easy. Gifford told her about how ghastly everyone had appeared right after impact, explaining how some hit harder than others. She was sorry she hadn't been there to help, but pleased she hadn't seen it. The thought of Tesh's crushed head and scattered teeth was difficult to hear, let alone witness. According to Gifford, the trio were much better than when he had found them. They had been the only ones to fall. According to Tesh, Moya and Rain had been taken by Feral. Miraculously, Tek Chin had turned up and freed Tesh from the Queen's Tower, but the two had been separated during the battle at the bridge. Tesh and Tressa had fallen when he broke the stone span to prevent the White Queen from getting Eton's key. The news that Moya wasn't with them was both a blessing and a curse. More than ever, Bryn felt the need for their confident, headstrong leader. While she was concerned about what Feral might do to Moya and Rain, she suspected they were better off than the ones who had fallen. "Those lost to the Abyss are never seen again." That was what Feral had said just before Bryn fell into the Abyss. Was she just being overly dramatic? I mean, yeah, it's far, but given enough time, we should be able to climb out. And I don't think time is the same in Pyre as it is in Alan. Looking at the sorry state of the others, she knew scaling the cliff walls wasn't possible. Not yet. They just need more time to heal. After finding them, the group had sat in the open for a long time. Bryn waited for Tesh, Gifford, or even Tressa to step forward with a plan. Being the youngest and an extraneous member of the group, she didn't think it was her place to step forward. When none of them had shown any sign of doing more than sitting, Bryn had asked for suggestions, but none was given. The only conversation revolved around being cold and wanting shelter. Which way to go or when to set out seemed too difficult a problem to overcome. Bryn had tried for consensus, calling for votes on various options. Even that proved to be too much. So she accepted the unwanted role of leader. Summoning her inner Moya, she barked them to their feet, demanding they walk, and kept everyone moving with the promise they could rest soon. She helped Gifford with Tressa, who could barely move. Between them, the older woman slumped and dragged her feet, leaving furrows in the frosty crust, torment displayed in the taut lines of her face. Tesh and Roan followed, helping each other. Neither looked good, as if every step was an agony. Bryn searched for a place that was sheltered, a niche or crevice, but she remained hesitant to get too close to the ravines, for fear of discovering more of the slug-like creatures. She had easily outrun the globs that had been drawn to her light like moths to flame, but didn't think Tressa and Tesh could do the same. Perhaps those creatures were harmless, but Bryn didn't want to risk finding out otherwise. Frustrated with her inability to find anything but open expanse, and plagued with complaints from the others about being exhausted, Bryn took note of some bits of shattered rock. In desperation, she steered them that way and found more. Pieces lay strewn across the ground. They ranged from boulders to chips. She followed the fragments and wondered where they had come from. A landslide? In the Abyss? She tracked the growing mounds of stone to the foot of a cliff. Quickly glancing around, she found the place devoid of globs. What's more, there was a cave, but it was a strange thing. Nothing about it appeared natural. The opening was huge and looks like something ripped the stone open, Gifford said, standing beside her, Tressa's opposite arm over his neck. He pointed at the distinct grooves in the rock, the same sort of marks a person left when digging in mud. Something big. Big didn't begin to describe the opening before them. By picking such a mundane word, Gifford was likely trying to minimize the possible implication, perhaps for her benefit. What Bryn saw was a hole ripped in the side of the cliff that would have required something with appendages larger than Gol, the one-eyed giant, or Balgargarath from Neath. Even if she and the rest of her group stood on one another's shoulders, they couldn't touch the top of the entrance's archway. What could have made this? She asked.
Dunno, Gifford replied. This is real stone, not created by a shim. What could dig through that? Should we go in?
I'm not sure.
I hear something, Roan said from behind them.
Both she and Tesh were looking back over their shoulders.
Something is coming.
They listened. It didn't take long before Bryn picked out the throbbing resonance. She'd never heard anything like it. Delivered in a constant rhythm, the sound was deep, below what normal living ears could hear. It reverberated off the cliffs and shook the frost-covered ground.
I think we should give it a try, Gifford said, pointing at the huge, gaping hole.
Bryn nodded.
I agree. Everyone inside.
Are you sure? Tesh asked. We don't know what's in there, and I can't fight. I can barely walk.
We don't know that anything is in there, Tesh, Bryn replied. But something is absolutely out here. It's getting closer, and I don't like the sound of it.
Focusing her attention on Gifford, she added, Just to err on the side of safety, let's lift Tressa for this last part so we don't leave a trail.
Good idea.
Stepping through the opening, they saw less a cave and more a deep tunnel. Its interior was littered with more wreckage, piles of shattered rock shoved to the sides. Much of it was the porous sort that Bryn had observed before, but as they went deeper, the rock changed. She saw streaks of lighter grey and white-lined layers like stripes of marble, even some yellow, and speckled sections of a rusty orange. At a place where the primary stone was a kind of slate, some of which was broken into thin sheets and piled along the sides, the tunnel ended near a trio of boulders. Here, deep in that passageway to nowhere, and hidden behind stacks of rubble, Bryn called a halt to their march. Instantly, the others collapsed like rag dolls. Tressa curled up into a ball. Tesh dropped beside her, and Roan and Gifford settled together against the tunnel's wall. They were a sorry sight.
Not great, Bryn thought, but better. At least the stone isn't frosted.
Looking back, she listened, but didn't hear the sound anymore.
I just hope that whatever we heard outside doesn't live in here.
They waited, and for a moment Bryn thought she heard the rhythmic rumbling sound again, but it soon faded. They were alone in the tunnel, a feeble pack of moles clustered in the dark. No one spoke. They were all too sick, each one suffering. Bryn wanted to help, but didn't know how. This was the abyss, the bottom, the lowest of the low, the dry well of the afterlife.
Those lost to the abyss are never seen again.
But why?
Bryn held on to the hope that they would eventually climb up, pass through the door to Allison, finish their mission, and save Moya, Tekchin, and Rain on their return trip. While the plan was optimistic, it was no more impossible than anything else they'd done. And yet, while looking at the others huddled on the floor, she had to ask herself, if climbing out is so easy, why hasn't anyone ever done it? When Moya had been in anguish from the loss of her leg, Bryn had gone in search of help, and found it. Buoyed by the memory of that success, she felt that searching was worth trying again, given that she didn't know what else to do.
I'm going to explore. The rest of you wait here.
Bryn, be careful,
Tesh said. He looked so pale, so weak.
I'll be fine. I'm just going to look around. Maybe I can find help, or an easy way out, or something useful. While I'm gone, everyone needs to rest. Get your strength back. We won't be staying for long. We have a mission to complete, remember?
Everyone nodded, except for Tressa, who didn't move at all. Bryn slipped outside. Free of the others, she moved quickly, surveying their surroundings at a brisk trot. The abyss was a quiet place, and when she stopped to listen, she heard nothing. Not a drip, squeak, rattle, or breath of wind stirred the place. Absolute silence was absolutely frightening. This time, Bryn stayed clear of the ravines and the pitted cliffs. She was out in the open again, and at her speed, it wasn't long before she returned to the fallen slabs of the bridge. The remnants had landed in a rough line.
Assuming they'd fallen straight down, Bryn figured she could use them as a perfect reference point to align herself to the upper tier of Nifril. Straight up was where the bridge had been. One end of the line of debris pointed at the plain of Kilkorth, while the other was an arrow aiming at the door to Alison. For a moment, Bryn felt wildly brilliant. I'm a veritable roan, I am. The moment faded as she saw no practical use for the knowledge, at least not yet. What she needed was a way to help the others regain their strength. She was also unable to determine which end of the series of stones was which. That would be important later. When they did climb out, it would be best to scale the pillar that led to the Alison door. Hoping to find a clue, she followed the row of bridge sections until she reached the end. Peering out into the darkness, she spotted a series of large, rocky mounds. One moved, and Bryn gasped and nearly bolted. A moment later, she recognized what she was seeing. The breakwaters. The giants appeared to sit or lie where they had fallen. Three still had their arms linked together. None spoke, nor did they move much. Each appeared befuddled. Watching them, Bryn was reminded of how Tesh, Tressa, and Roan had just sat where they fell. Slowly, the giants' heads turned. They could see her, of course. Without anything to block her light, it must be visible for miles, and in that eternal dark, light would be hope. The idea came to her then. In Pyre, nothing physical existed. Everything was manifested from the spirit. Bryn had no legs or feet, yet she understood that's how she moved. Light was the same. There was no true illumination. Or perhaps she was simplifying too much. Light might also encompass confidence, belief, faith. Each generated a kind of power on the spiritual plane, and that power showed itself in the form of light. That was why the blobs had chased her. She was a beacon of hope. Not wanting to get any closer to the breakwaters, Bryn returned up the line of debris in the opposite direction. Eventually, she reached a rough column of stone, the Alison Pillar. Some call it the Needle. Bryn paused at the base and looked up. The door to Alison is at the top. Her light revealed jagged rocks with ledges and plenty of cracks and crevices. Bryn reached up, gripped one of the many handholds, and pulled. Hoisting her body to the nearest ledge was like lifting a pillow filled with no more than 10 feathers. She climbed to the next ledge, and the next, feeling elated. As inspiration took over, Bryn's excitement grew, and she found herself jumping through the air and catching one outcropping after another. This is so easy. Climbing out is possible. She let go and floated down. Elated at her discovery, Bryn grinned. Not only had she found the pillar and proved that the climb was possible, she had also managed to develop a mental map of the abyss. The broken bridge was at the center of the canyon, and the breakwaters were at one end, nearest the Queen's Tower. On the opposite side was the Alison Pillar. To the right lay the giant tunnel where she had left everyone. To the left lay, she wasn't sure what. Just one way to find out, she told herself. Returning to the center of the bridge's debris, she turned left and began walking, in the direction she arbitrarily proclaimed to be north. She hadn't traveled far on the open expanse of frost-covered ground when she reached a wide track of bare rock. One portion led due north, the other curved toward one of the many fissures heading roughly in what would be east. It's like a road, but to where? She'd begun to follow it north when, far ahead, she saw something, a light. It was the only thing she was able to see at such a distance. Outside of Gifford's pale glow, Bryn had found no source of illumination beyond her own. People, she thought. Maybe it's a whole city of them, helping one another cope and drawing strength from their entire community. Except,
this light was different. Not the pale white or bluish color that she and Gifford gave off. This one had a decidedly red glow, and it wasn't firelight because it didn't flicker. There was nothing warm about it. Appearing like a rose-colored rising sun, it had to be enormous given the great distance between her and it. Then, as she watched, she realized it was moving. Coming at her. That's when she heard the sound again. That horrible rumbling beat.
Not a city. The source of that light is something that moves along this road, whose passage has worn it away.
This time, Bryn did not ask herself what Moya might do. She didn't care. She wasn't Moya, and the red light scared her. Every instinct she possessed told her to leave, and quickly. Turning away, she ran.
"We can get out," Bryn told them. "I found the pillar that leads to the Allison door, and it's easy to climb. We shouldn't have much trouble."
The news, Bryn was confident, was the remedy. Once they heard their troubles were over, hope would return. They would glow with the joy of relief. Strength would surge back into them in the same way that Roan and Tesh had managed to restore themselves after receiving the power of love and reassurance that Gifford and Bryn had administered. They would rise up, and as soon as she was certain that nasty red glow had gone its normal route up the road, she would lead them out and they would begin scaling the pillar. Together, they could do it. Bryn was certain of that. But they did not glow or rise. They looked back with those same tired eyes.
"How?"
Gifford asked, sitting up with his arms around Roan, whose head was nestled on his chest. Bryn knelt down before them.
"I just told you. I found the pillar, the one with the door to Allison on top. It's so easy to climb."
Gifford blinked. Tesh rocked back. Roan opened her mouth, but no words came out. Tressa simply laughed, a cold, miserable sound.
"Did you say climb?" the woman asked. "Like in all the way back up to where we fell from?"
Bryn frowned.
"Yes, of course."
"Bryn," Tesh said, "I don't think I could walk up a flight of stairs."
"I might be able to climb," Gifford said. "But Bryn, you're talking about, I don't know, miles maybe.
Miles straight up. But we don't get tired. Not in here, not really. And it doesn't look that difficult.
Besides, difficult hasn't stopped us before. Defying Conagher was hard. Getting past Gronbach was hopeless. Defeating Udgar and subduing the Gula was futile. Fighting Bolgargarath was absurd. Winning against the full force of the Fane was impossible. But each time we succeeded, I think we can again. The handholds are plentiful, and there are lots of ledges to rest on. It will be easy."
"For you, maybe,"
Tressa said. The woman was sprawled against the wall, her head slumped off to one side as if she were a rag puppet that a dog had just finished playing with.
"I swear I weigh 1,000 pounds down here. It's so much worse than when we were on the plain of Kilcorth, and my bones are still broken."
"But you don't actually weigh anything. And you don't have bones. If you really weighed so much, you'd have cracked the stone when you hit. Did you?"
"Honestly, I didn't check. Maybe."
"Come on, you have to try. Stand up. All of you. Let's go, right now. You'll see. Once you get started, once you understand how easy it is, you'll gain confidence and strength. And with each step, it will get easier."
"It's not that we want to stay here, Bryn," Tesh said. "But it's like you're asking us to sprout wings and fly. I can't do that. It took every ounce of effort I had just to walk over here."
"He's right," Brown said. "I'm exhausted, too." "Okay. Fine. We can wait for a while. You rest. But as soon as you're able, we climb."
The crack in the back of the cave bothered Bryn, like when a tongue probed the empty spot after a tooth came loose. She'd been staring at it for... she actually didn't know how long. That was one of the problems with the afterlife. There was no way to tell time. Maybe it didn't exist. There were events, certainly. One followed the next. But time, as she had always understood it, didn't seem to apply anymore. If nothing happened, if she sat in one place like the breakwaters, as she was doing right now, she was certain time stopped. Maybe not for everyone, but it would for her. The others remained clustered near the wall where they had first collapsed. She could see Gifford's light, and Roan glowed, but with far less radiance. Her light was overwhelmed by his. Tesh had no light at all. And Tressa, Bryn had refused to believe it before, but there was no denying it now. Tressa emitted a darkness. All of them together didn't come close to Bryn's brilliance, which illuminated one whole side of the cavern. For a long time, she had waited near the tunnel entrance, keeping watch for the source of that red glow and horrible noise. On a regular basis, she heard it approach before fading away once more. Whatever it is, it's following a route, patrolling. Is it habit, or is the red light looking for something? Bryn didn't know how, but she sensed the red light was bad. Something to be feared and avoided. She returned often to check on the progress of the others. They never appeared any better. If anything, they seemed worse. Knowing their weakness wasn't physical, she tried to cheer them up. Told them stories, the ones Maeve had forced her to practice so long ago. Tales of heroes overcoming massive adversity. Chronicles of men and women who, even when they were certain they couldn't win, tried and somehow persevered. That's what stories were for, Bryn realized. They were magic that aided people in times like this. They provided hope, a light to see by when all others were snuffed out. Her companions appreciated the tales, and they looked a bit better as she recited them. But the healing properties weren't good enough. Tressa was hardly able to lift her head. Bryn was getting frustrated by their lack of progress and went off to sit on her own. That was when she noticed the opening in the back of the tunnel. She moved toward it and sat down, chin on hands, elbows on knees, staring for what could have been hours. "You're looking at the crack, aren't you?" Roan said, shattering Bryn's timeless bubble. She'd crept over so soundlessly that Bryn jumped. "Sorry. I didn't mean to startle you." "No, no, it's wonderful," Bryn said, and shifted over, giving Roan a space to sit. "I'm glad to see you up and moving around. Are you feeling better?"
"A little. Your stories help."
"That's great. I'll tell more then."
"We need to get out of here, Roan. Think of Moya, Tekchin, and Rain up there with the Queen. She might be torturing them. If we can just..."
"It's too high for us, Bryn," Roan said, shutting her down.
"Your stories help, but they're not enough. They treat the symptom, not the malady."
"It's only another problem, Roan, a puzzle to be worked out.
You're so good at that.
The Land of Nog, remember?"
"I didn't name it that."
"No, you made it that. All I'm asking is that you figure a way to get everyone up that pillar." Roan looked away, with defeat in her eyes. Bryn realized that Roan couldn't do it, wouldn't do it, because she didn't think it was possible. This was a side of her friend that Bryn had never seen before. Usually, Roan thought anything was possible. She often speculated that with the right resources, she could fly, make it rain, and eliminate sickness from the world.
"What's happening to her? How can she believe that escaping the abyss is beyond her reach? And if it's too far for the Wizard of Nog, what chance do the others have?"
"Those lost to the abyss are never seen again."
Wait!
Bryn raised a finger, holding up the point she was about to make.
What about Rain?
Beatrice saw in the future he would be a king, and he can't leave without Tressa's key. So getting out must be possible. She saw it happen.
Roan looked uncomfortable and drew her feet in, as if to stand. She was going to leave.
Or maybe Beatrice was crazy,
Bryn quickly said. She smiled.
Don't go.
Roan hesitated, as if deciding.
And yes, to answer your question,
Bryn added. I was looking at the crack.
It's stupid, but I feel like I've seen it before.
You have, Roan said, letting her legs stretch out across the stone again. We've both seen the three boulders over there, too.
Bryn turned around and gasped.
You're right.
She still couldn't remember where, but she had seen them. Them and the crack.
How?
Then the two clicked together in her mind, and everything made sense. Not according to reason, but rather a sort of dream logic. She remembered. The whole thing was impossible, and yet...
Bryn stood up, rising, her light extended farther, but not far enough.
If this is the crack, if this is that crack, then...
Bryn began to walk toward it.
But it can't be.
We were down pretty deep. Roan slowly got to her feet and followed.
Not this deep.
Bryn purposely moved very slowly. She wanted Roan to stay with her as the two crept toward the back of the cave.
Then how do you explain the crack?
Roan asked. She was directly behind, her words giving voice to Bryn's own thoughts.
It is the same, isn't it? Bryn said. And it's hard to forget that opening. We stared at it for so long.
Bryn felt Roan take her hand. Roan had never touched her before. By accident sometimes, but not intentionally, and certainly not for more than a second. Roan was better about contact these days. She didn't panic the way she used to, but as far as Bryn knew, Gifford was still the only one whose touch she was comfortable with. Bryn was so shocked that she looked down to make sure it was Roan's fingers she felt. Together they moved forward, watching as the far edge of Bryn's light revealed more and more of the rock and floor. Then Roan stopped and gasped. Bryn saw it too. On the ground was what looked like a stick. But it wasn't. Too straight. And there was a sharpened stone tip. A tiny spear. An arrow.
Mother of all,
Bryn said, wide-eyed. Roan bent down and tried to pick it up, but she was unable to affect it, just as she couldn't alter the stone they stood on.
It's the practice arrow, Roan said. The one Persephone made Moya warm up with before going after Belgargarath. The one she flung into the dark. How can it be here?
Roan didn't answer. The two moved ahead once more, slower this time.
There,
Roan pointed.
Bryn caught the glint of silver metal on the floor near the wall. I can't believe it.
Reaching down, Bryn tried to pick up Persephone's lost talk. But just as with the arrow, she could feel it, but not move it. Then Bryn stood and looked at Roan.
We're in the Agave again.
Bryn noticed that Roan's light was brighter.
Was it hope? Maybe with Roan, a puzzle of this magnitude is fuel.
They advanced to the crack at the rear wall. But now Bryn realized it wasn't the rear, but the front. Beyond it, there would be the pool with the blue glowing lichen and the stair that led up.
They could get out, as they had before, by climbing the steps through Neath to emerge at Carrick on the banks of the Blue Sea.
Bryn was only inches away from the crack. When she stepped forward, intending to pass through the rip that the Balgargarath had torn open, she hit something solid, bounced back, and fell. Roan reached out and her hand was likewise blocked.
It's the division between the worlds.
She looked back.
When the little men and Moya were exploring, they found something like this, but it was back there.
She pointed past the boulders.
This place, the Agave, is like a bubble that extends into both worlds. The area between is common to each, but there is also a separation that keeps the two worlds apart. Coming from Neith, the barrier is back there. But coming from the Abyss, the barrier is at this crack. But beyond it...
Ron rotated slowly, her eyes taking in everything, nodding as she put the pieces together. Bryn had her own revelation.
This is where the Ancient One was. He wasn't imprisoned, he was dead. But he got out. So we can too.
Ron shook her head.
Don't do that, Bryn snapped. This was the answer, their salvation. Maybe they couldn't climb the pillar, but they could get to the back of the stupid cave. She and Gifford could drag them if necessary. The weight of Nifril, which had intensified in the Abyss, would be gone once they were back on the face of Alan. We can get past this barrier. We have the key. This makes everything work out. Beatrice wasn't crazy. Malcolm is right, and the key really can open any door.
Rowan nodded.
Yes, the key will likely work, but it won't help us.
What do you mean?
Bryn thrust a pointed finger at the crack.
That's our way out. I don't think so.
Bryn wanted to slap her.
Why not? Three reasons. One, our bodies aren't nearby. They are back in a mud puddle in the swamp of Ith, and so we'll travel as, I don't know, as ghosts, I guess. We'll be like Meeks. We can sneak aboard a trade ship going from Carrick to Tyre. Then we can walk back to Ith and get our bodies.
It will take too long. Our bodies will rot. We'll remain ghosts. Bryn frowned.
Well, it's better than being in here. We'll also fail our quest. Give up on Suri. We'll have died for nothing.
This reason had more impact, and Bryn paused to consider it. As she did, Rowan added one more rock to the pile. Third, we can't pass through stone. Bryn struggled to understand.
Why would we need to... Suri collapsed the mountain, remember. Neith is buried under a mountain of rubble. We won't be able to get through it.
You don't know that for sure. You're only guessing.
That's true,
Ron conceded.
But it's likely.
We need to at least try. I'm getting really tired of everyone just giving up. Come on, let's get the key and...
Bryn saw the apprehension in Ron's eyes.
Okay, fine. You wait here, I'll go fetch it.
Ron smiled, nodded, and sat down right where she was. Their little stroll must have been difficult for her. Bryn returned to the others. They hadn't moved. If anything, they appeared more settled, less upright.
Everyone appeared to be sleeping. Tressa, she said gently, can you hear me?
The older woman opened her eyes but said nothing.
May I borrow the key?
So you're leaving us at last?
No, but I think I might have found a way for everyone to get out.
Tressa looked at Tesh, then at Gifford, and gave a sigh.
Fine, but you'll have to take it off me. I can't. I don't have the strength.
Bryn crouched down beside her. As she reached around Tressa's neck and the two were cheek to cheek, Tressa reached up and grabbed Bryn's arm. The older woman whispered in her ear,
There's a secret you need to know. Something Malcolm told me. The last thing. He said I had to wait until the very end. Because, as he explained, Bryn is the only one who's going to make it. So she's the only one who needs to know.
Bryn gasped.
What?
She said, trying to pull back, but Tressa's grip was too tight. Tressa went on, her voice barely loud enough to hear.
We didn't come for Suri. This quest was never about her.
Malcolm needed us to do something far more important, but knew we wouldn't go unless I said it was to save the Mystic. The real reason for this trip is to return with something called the Horn of Glindora. It's like the key, made of both Eton and Elan, so you'll be able to carry it back through Pyre.
Bryn shook her head.
I don't understand. Did you really think the doors to the afterlife were open for us to save the life of one wild Mystic girl? Sori would have to die if she were to return with us. And I'm shocked none of you geniuses realized that. This has always been about more. Much more. If you can get that horn to Nephron, not only will it end the war, but we'll also help fix the world that Malcolm broke. And that will be beneficial for everyone. Everywhere.
Bryn stared at Tressa, then once more started to draw back, but Tressa held on.
I also want to apologize about lying, but it was necessary. That's why Malcolm picked me. He knew I was good at it. You see, when you want to build a wall, you ask a mason. And nothing. I'm sorry, I...
She let go of Bryn, who staggered backward. With tears in her eyes, Tressa continued,
I'm sorry I threw your book in the river. You didn't deserve that. You were trying to help me. And I just couldn't believe you were being sincere. Seeing your face, I had no idea how much your book meant to you. It's stupid, but of all the terrible things I've done, I think I hate myself the most for that. I had nightmares afterward. Terrible dreams where I kept looking for the pages and couldn't find them. I've got plenty of reasons to hate myself, believe me. I've done much worse. But not to a person who is so.
Her lips squeezed tight in a Padera-like frown.
I'm just sorry, okay?
Bryn nodded.
It's all right. I forgive you, Tressa.
The elder woman's head came up and her lips quivered.
Don't say that. Just take the damn key. I think...
Tressa swallowed.
I think he always meant for you to have it. Malcolm was just letting me feel important by being the one to carry it. He was being nice. So few ever have been.
Bryn slipped the key's chain over Tressa's head.
We'll get out, Tressa. We all will. You'll see. I'm going to make sure about that.
She stood up.
You rest now. I'll make it right. I promise.
Bryn walked back to where Roan waited, looking like a lost puppy, her dim glow washed away by Bryn's brilliance.
What's wrong? Roan asked. Nothing. Well, I'm concerned about Tressa. I think maybe this place is messing with her mind. She's talking nonsense.
Bryn looked back.
At least I think she is. Doesn't matter. I have the key. Let's go.
Bryn held the end of the key out and moved to the barrier, then stopped.
What if I get out, but then I can't get back in again?
Roan shook her head.
It opens all doors. Besides, getting in doesn't seem to be the hard part.
Bryn nodded.
Right. Of course. Here goes.
Ducking her head, Bryn took a step into the crack. Her light went out, and almost immediately she hit something hard. As she jumped back, her light returned. Turning, she saw Roan staring at her with that typically curious stare of hers.
What happened?
Nothing. It doesn't work,
Bryn said.
I'm still hitting the barrier, but my light went out.
No.
Roan shook her head.
I saw you disappear.
You did?
You passed back into Elan and vanished.
Would my light work in Elan?
Roan shrugged.
Probably not. The light is spiritual strength. You can't see that in Elan.
Right.
Bryn turned back and took a breath as if going underwater, and once more she stepped forward. Again her light went out,
and again she immediately encountered an impediment. This time, she let her fingers explore. What she felt was different from the barrier. She felt the edges of the crack and, beyond it, stone. Rough and cold. She felt sharp edges, flat blocks and gaps. She was feeling the cave-in that was just beyond the bubble of the agave. What lay beyond the crack was an impassable mound of debris. Stepping back, Bryn's light returned, and once more she saw Roan. Don't you hate always being right?
Chapter 7 Faith on Trial. Faith is trust pushed to the limit of what is considered sane. But the question most people ignore is, how do you know where the boundary of sanity lies? The Book of Bryn. Malcolm dusted snow off his arms and shoulders as he entered Persephone's tent.
Sorry I'm late. I only just heard you wanted to see me.
Justine and Nolan were still at the Padera Memorial Meal Tent for breakfast, a luxury Persephone no longer had time for. They were leaving. Nephrin was designating priorities for the preparation to break camp, and Sikar was mercifully absent from his post, leaving Malcolm and her alone. Such a private moment wouldn't last long. This was the calm before the storm.
What is it you need? He asked.
Oh, let's not go there, for I have a long list. From you, however, I'd be satisfied with a few answers. For instance, she pointed at the black bronze sword. You mentioned I needed to keep that. Nephrin feels it's a danger to our security. Is there any reason I can't get rid of it? Can I melt it down, bury it, or toss it in a lake? If not, can we at least send it miles away?
Yes.
Yes, what? Destroy, bury, toss, or send away?
None of the above. I was answering your first question. Yes, there is a reason you can't get rid of it. It will be needed.
Persephone waited. She stared at the tall, thin man, but he made no move to elaborate. Instead, he began searching his sleeves for snowflakes he might have missed. Finally, she sighed. Can I hide it?
No.
Why?
Because that'll make it difficult to find.
Malcolm smiled sweetly. In frustration, Persephone slammed her hands on the arms of her chair. Habit's makeshift first chair that he had brought from the ruins of Alan Rist. She stood up because she couldn't sit any longer. What's going on, Malcolm? When last we spoke, you told me a fairy tale about Moya leading her party into the afterlife on a mission to save Suri and win this war. Now the Frey have dragons, which means Suri is dead, and we must now pull back. We'll be going to...
You can't retreat.
Why?
Because you have to stay here.
Malcolm spoke as if his words were common knowledge and she was spouting nonsense.
Nephrin especially. If you want to win this war, if you want everyone to survive, that's what is necessary.
At the risk of sounding like my son, I must repeat, why? He shook his head, appearing frustrated.
Explanations require too many details. Everything would be so much easier if people simply accepted what I say.
Persephone pursed her lips, laboring to suppress a scream. She fought the impulse to throttle Malcolm to make him understand she wanted, no, needed answers, not games. Instead, she tried logic. Your hesitation to be forthright creates doubt and suspicion. It's natural to be wary. If I have nothing to fear regarding your motives and methods, why keep secrets?
If Moya were forced to shoot an apple off the top of Nolan's head, would you badger her with questions while she did it? Would you demand that she explain the minutiae of archery while taking aim, even though you couldn't possibly understand anything she said?
Persephone's mouth hung open for just a moment at both the words and the gall. Did you just say, I'm an idiot?
And are you actually equating my desire to learn more before risking the lives of thousands of people to a distraction? I don't think you should brush my concerns aside so casually. This is important.
Even more than you could guess, Malcolm said. And it's far more dangerous than whether a few thousand people will live or die. He looked up at the canvas ceiling for a long moment, then sighed. Every word I tell you has repercussions. Pebbles tossed into a pond send out ripples. You don't see them, but I do. Many of them are needed, others are counterproductive, and some are downright disastrous. You're asking me to walk across a frozen lake of thin ice for no reason.
And you want me to risk the fate of the human race on faith?
Exactly. And my question to you is this. Why isn't that enough? The sounds of people working came through the canvas walls, belongings being packed, wagons being loaded, tent stakes being pried up. The camp was awake, and the news was spreading. Persephone felt derelict by not helping, and Malcolm was delaying her further. She threw up her hands and shook her head.
Are you joking?
No, I'm not. When Moya told you she could defeat Udgar, you had faith. When Arion said she could handle a giant, you believed. When Nephron declared you should take Alonrist with a handful of Galantians, you took him at his word. On trust.
Because I had proof of their abilities. I saw Moya kill Balgargarath, Arion fight Grindel, and the Galantians dispatch an attack of giants.
And what of me?
He said, as if he alone had failed to receive an invitation to her exclusive party.
That's just it, Malcolm. I don't know anything about you.
Not really.
You seem as if you can tell the future, but I don't know how accurate you are. I have no proof of your abilities, no reason to trust you.
Malcolm frowned. He looked hurt, even as he nodded.
That's what this has come down to. Trust and belief, two commodities which are obviously in short supply. You see, when I mentioned Balgargarath, Udgar, and Alonrist, I wasn't giving examples of others you trusted. I was presenting evidence to support why you ought to believe me. All those events, and so many more, came to fruition through my efforts.
She raised a skeptical eyebrow.
Malcolm counted on his fingers as he talked.
Udgar was defeated because you challenged to be Keenig, and you were able to do that because you were chieftain, and you were chieftain because you were Reglan's wife. Reglan married you because years before you were born, I told Tura to make sure Reglan's father would pair you two.
Persephone opened her mouth to protest, but Malcolm went on.
Balgargarath's defeat was in large part due to Suri, but she wouldn't have been there if I hadn't told Tura to look for an infant near the Cascades on the first full moon after summer's rule of that year. Nephrin revolted against Petragar at Alonrist because I convinced his father to challenge Lothian. This set his feet on a path toward rebellion, which led him to Dol Ren. In truth, you have far more reason to trust me than anyone you know.
Persephone had no idea what to think. He was lying to her. Had to be. There was no way Malcolm could have arranged for her marriage or known about Suri. And yet, why would he lie about such things?
She'd known him for years. He'd always been a good friend. And Malcolm always seemed wise in an awkward kind of way.
You knew Tura?
Since she was born. I was the one who brought her to the Crescent Forest, so she could be the Mystic of Ren and the fulcrum of so many events.
Tura was ancient. But you're
a bit older than I look,
he smiled.
It sounds so unlikely.
Malcolm nodded.
And yet, when most put a paddle in the water to steer their boat, the water never demands explanations or reassurance about the choices made.
He shrugged. However, we're getting close to the end. Little can affect the outcome at this point. So, as long as you promise not to ask questions, I can tell you some things.
Persephone waited as Malcolm took a deep breath. Despite remaining undecided on whether he was being truthful, a liar, or utterly mad, she braced herself for his next words, as if he were about to proclaim an irrevocable sentence on the guilty.
What Tressa told you was close to the truth. I sent them into Pyre as a means of reaching Suri in Estramnadon.
So, are you saying Suri is still alive?
Malcolm rolled his eyes.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
She held up her hands in penance.
No questions. I forgot. Please, go on.
I can only see, foretell, if you will, what happens outside Pyre. So I have no idea what is going on inside or how those events will play out. I only know that there will be a race against time. And if this camp moves from this spot, he pointed at his feet,
that race will be lost, and along with it, the war, and quite possibly a great deal more.
And you did all this?
No, Malcolm said. You, Sori, Wraith, Nephron, and untold others accomplished it. I merely put the right people in the correct place at the needed time.
Persephone took a seat on her bed and ran a hand through her hair.
Your decision is simple.
He spoke to her with warmth and compassion, yet she felt he was belittling her struggle, her pain, and the terror that caused all her muscles to tense. She was a table bearing too much weight. And Malcolm was dismissing the pressure as if it were nothing, and her decisions easy.
Oh, is it?
She looked up, irritated.
There is but one thing you must do. Answer a single question. Do you trust me? Everything else is irrelevant.
That's a pretty big question, Malcolm.
Yes, but it's an easy one to resolve.
He turned and pulled the collar of his cloak up.
Because you knew the answer to that question before I came in.
Then, as he walked out, he added,
and so did I.
Persephone found Nephron in the healing quarter, where a small crowd had gathered outside one of the tents. Stepping inside, Persephone saw a man lying on a cot.
What's happening? She said.
They found him lying face down in the snow, just 60 yards outside the camp,
Nephron replied. He looked familiar. She thought his name might be Norge, or perhaps Nachman. Born of Clan Tyre, he was one of the commanders of the troops Nephron had sent to establish a safe route across the Nidwalden, south of the falls. He was covered in blood, his fingers black, as was the tip of his nose.
Frostbite.
She'd seen it before. His feet would likely be worse. Anuval, the attending Frey physician who had helped heal her after the Rao attack, was heaping fur blankets on the injured man. Two men and three women rushed around his cot, carrying heated water and carting away